PPI.org. Good evening. Thanks for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Good evening, Charlene. Tonight, we are speaking with Anita Cameron. Hello, Anita.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me tonight. Anita is with ADAPT. I really appreciate you coming on, Anita. I don't know where it is where you are, but where we are, it is cold.
Yeah, it's pretty cold here.
Yeah.
So yeah, we get similar temperatures.
Yeah.
And we're actually closer to Canada than the state of Pennsylvania. We're in Western New York. And so we get all that stuff they get.
Excellent. Not so much, right?
Yeah.
So, Anita, ADAPT. Tell me a little bit about ADAPT. Tell me a little bit about the beginning, when it started, and what you know about it.
Well, ADAPT was started officially in 1983.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, it seems like there's an echo or something. Oh. But anyway, so ADAPT was started in Denver in 1983.
Uh-huh.
I joined ADAPT in 1986,
okay,
in Chicago. At that time, ADAPT was a small group of people with disabilities. The vast majority of us used wheelchairs, and there were some of us who walked on our hind feet. We had hidden disabilities.
Gotcha.
And I was one of them. I was 21 years old when I joined ADAPT. And I've seen quite a few changes over the decades.
And what made you join?
Well, I had been involved in social justice work from the age of 16.
Wow,
I
good for you.
In the movement.
Excellent.
ADAPT was, it's an interesting story that I was staying with my godmother, who's a school sister of Notre Dame. That's her religious order. She got a call from a friend saying that he knew someone with a disability who needed an interpreter and an assistant. And my godmother thought that that would be just the thing for me. And so she had me call the man up. His name was Dennis Driver. He worked at Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind. Mm-hmm. Because of the type of sign language that he used, you had to be a very good speller. And so he gave me a 20-word spelling test. Couldn't believe that I passed it. Gave me another one. Couldn't believe that I passed it. Gave me another one. Couldn't believe that I passed it. Brought me in on an interview and hired me on the spot.
Excellent.
And then I began working on the local level with my local ADAPT chapter.
So in the ADAPT, I'm sure like some of the stuff that it's always changing as far as what you guys are working on, depending on, you know, what's going on in society. Has it changed, do you think, how involved people are?
Well, we were a small group.
Right.
We used to would have probably about 30 or 40 people on national average.
Uh-huh.
Over the years, we grew and grew rather exponentially. We would have about 500 to 600 people on actions. But the thing is that when you're dealing with a lot of folks with disabilities, people pass away, they die.
Yeah.
Their health gets, you know, too bad to be active. They go on with their lives.
Right.
They live their lives. And so our numbers have diminished, but we're still strong, and we are working on getting youth involved and adapt, and working on getting more people of color involved in ADAPT, because ADAPT was, although it was diverse, it was a reflection of society, and that the default is white, mm-hmm. particularly white men. And so over the years, that has changed, but it has not changed enough. And that is what I have been doing to get more black leadership in ADAPT, because we have people of color in leadership positions in ADAPT. We just don't have very many black folks in positions of leadership in ADAPT. And that's all due to that structural racism. You know, and it doesn't mean that people are bad. People just do what the default is. And so those are the changes that we've done. We started out working on access to public transit as well as public access. When the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law, we hearkened back to our roots. And so we tried to work to get 25% of Medicaid dollars redirected into a national attendant services program. Mm-hmm. And our first piece of legislation was H.R. 2020. It was introduced by Newt Gingrich, who was then Speaker of the House. And that was quite interesting to get him to do that. It involved some protests at his house, but he did do that. The bill has had several iterations since then. It started out as Community Attendant Service Act, and then the Medicaid Community Attendant Service Act, and then the Medicaid Community Attendant Services and Supports Act, and then the Community Integration, the Community Choice Act. And all of those were what I tend to call program bills.
What was that program?
I'm sorry?
Program what?
Program bills.
Oh, okay.
So what happens is that it was trying to change a Medicaid program, mm-hmm. and trying to mandate a Medicaid benefit for people who were in nursing homes or in danger of being sent to a nursing home. And we got pushback on that. And so when the Disability Integration Act was being crafted for the 115th Congress, we decided to look at it and frame it as civil rights legislation. because you can have all of the public access that you want. You can have all the access to God and things of that nature. But if you are stuck in a nursing home, you're not going to have access to that. And so we realized that people had to have an actual civil right to live in the community with the services and support that, you know, that we need to remain independent and to remain in our home. And so that's where that is now. On January 15th, which was the 90th anniversary of the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Disability Integration Act was reintroduced in Washington, D.C. It was a huge thing. It was amazing. I was honored to emcee the event. Senator Schumer, who is the sponsor on the Senate side of the bill, was there. Cory Gardner, who was the first Republican on the Senate side, he was there.
Excellent.
And that was pretty amazing because I lived in Denver for many, many years, a couple of decades. And Senator Gardner, let's just say he kind of wasn't feeling things and had us arrested multiple times. But at the end of the year of 2018, he was literally the last person to sign on to DIA in the Senate, making the bill both bipartisan and bicameral. And to his extraordinary credit, Senator Gardner was the first initial co-sponsor on the Senate bill. And he was also there. I got to introduce him. Senator Casey was there. Congressman Sensenbrenner sent staff because he's recovering from surgery. And so he sent staff. He is the sponsor of the House version of the bill. So the House version of the bill is H.R. 555. It had 40 initial co-sponsors on the 15th. We are now up to 52 co-sponsors. And the Senate bill is S-117. And it has 23 original co-sponsors. So the bill is both bipartisan and bicameral. And now the hard work begins. Because we have called for the House version of the bill to be passed by July 26, 2019. And then the Senate bill to pass and for DIA to be signed into law by the year 2020.
Can you talk a little bit about what that bill does for the disability community?
It gives people with disabilities who are either in nursing homes or are in danger of being in nursing homes a civil right to live in the community with the services and support that they need to remain independent. It directs insurance companies who will pay for institutional care to also pay for home and community-based services. There are a number of components as part of that bill, including a housing component, because people with disabilities are often stuck in nursing homes simply because there is no affordable, accessible housing. There's a transportation component. There are a number of different components of this bill that would give that civil right to folks who have a nursing home level of care need to receive services in their homes.
And presumably, the bill's asking for the insurance companies, if you would pay thousands of dollars or however much you would pay for a nursing home, you should be willing to pay for the same amount for that person to live in their own home. Yes?
Well, yeah, but you know what? It costs far less to care for someone in their own homes than in a nursing home.
What?
Okay, I'll give you and this is a 2009 figure.
Okay.
Okay, so it's probably even better now. But in 2009, it cost a little over $250,000 a year per person to be taken care of in a nursing home. Whereas to take care of that same person in their own home, it costs a little over $50,000 a year. So it costs about one-fifth the cost. And I'm sure the numbers have improved now. That's one of the things that we are doing is to push towards a hearing, to work on studies to give numbers that are up to date. And so that the whole scoring thing won't be inflated, because that's the thing that a lot of people talk about, scoring. Scoring is like how the bill will be paid. But the thing is that there is a price on the freedom of people with disabilities that should not be. And that's one of the that's one of the really frustrating things, is that there's always a price for our freedom.
Why do you feel like there's pushback on this bill, or why are people dragging their feet?
I don't know. I don't really want to speculate, although I can imagine that some of the members of Congress live in districts where there are either a lot of nursing homes or they live in a district with the largest nursing home in the country, and they are beholden to people, whether it's the union or the nursing home owners or the nursing home lobby. It seemed like there was a lot of support, particularly from the Democrats. But when we were getting ready for the reintroduction, it seemed like they were kind of running. And I'll tell you something that's a little frustrating to me. The Dems have put forth some legislation that they're going to push through, okay, whether it's the Equality Act or various other acts that protect various groups of people who are marginalized. However, there's nothing in there for people with disabilities. Nothing. They always leave us out. And then wonder why we're angry. You know, wonder why we push back on them. And I don't think that it's a matter of an afterthought. I don't think that they forgot. I just think that we are not a powerful, we're not powerful constituents. We don't have that kind of money. And so we don't matter. And so I thank the Democrats in the House and the Senate who have supported us and who signed on to this bill. But we've got a fight on our hands. And it's interesting when you have some of the most absolutely conservative Republicans signing on to this bill. Mm. And you have Democrats who are consistently leaving us out of their plans and their equation. And then wonder why we come after them. Because ADAPT is nonpartisan. Okay? We will protest, you know, we'll protest anyone, Democrat or Republican. If you are messing with our community, if you're messing with our civil rights, if you're messing with our freedoms and liberties, you will hear from ADAPT, and it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. That's just the way we are.
Right, because theoretically, there should be a whole money savings in this. So you should, I would think the Republicans would be all about this.
Well, I mean, and the Republicans are. We haven't had, I mean, it was a bit of a struggle, but once we got folks signed on, I mean, the entire Colorado contingent signed on, and that includes some of the most conservative Republicans in Congress signed on and are signing on. And were some of the original co-sponsors of the bill.
Right, because everyone wants to save money now. Do you feel, huh? is it the bill must make, I mean, does it make a difference with, let's say somebody wants to stay in their own home, but there must be a cutoff point, right? If they require just so much care, it's going to be really hard? No,
not at all. They get all of the services and support that they need to remain at home. That is what this bill is about. That is the nature of the bill. Because when you start talking cutoffs, then once again, you're saying that there are people who are too disabled to be in the community. Mm. And that is untrue. I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
From when I worked in Denver under Wade Blank, who's the founder of ADAPT.
Okay.
We had one of our original folks, Jim Lundvall. Jim's house was set on fire. It was a hate crime. Oh. They set his ramp on fire, and it went into the house, and he was unconscious, and he was put in the hospital on life support. And after a while, his parents decided to remove him from life support. But Jim did not die. And so we placed Jim in his own apartment with round-the-clock attendant services. And he stayed there for another year and a half. He finally ended up dying of the of complications from the original attack.
Yeah.
But he lived in his own apartment for the last year and a half of his life. And he was in a coma, but he was well taken care of. People took him to some of his favorite places, you know, took him to the park, took him to the office, played his favorite music. He had people with him 24/7. I saw that for myself. I watched that for myself. I participated in that for myself. And if we could have someone in a coma living in his own place, surely anyone can.
Of course, now you have the struggle of the whole PCAs in general, right?
Well, yeah, that's another component of the bill, is that we're pushing for livable wages for PCAs, because most PCAs do not get anywhere near a living wage. It is a shame, and no disrespect to folks who work at McDonald's, but it is a shame that you can make more flipping burgers at McDonald's than you can taking care of and being responsible for someone's life.
That is quite amazing, isn't it? Sad.
Yes, and it's obscene, to be honest.
Yes. So,
and so that's another component, you know, of this, and another campaign that ADAPT is working on, in addition to introducing this component into the Disability Integration Act, because we care about our attendants. Our attendants are family to us. You know, and we love them, and we want them to be able to make a living wage. It's a shame that, you know, you have attendants in some areas of the country only making $9 an hour.
There also seems to be...
You know, I mean, how can you live off of that?
You cannot.
Exactly. And so it's a number. This Disability Integration Act involves a whole bunch of things, you know, that we thought about, you know, because basically this bill was written by the people with disabilities that went through this. And then we sent it on to, you know, the folks to get the legalese language, you know, in that. But this bill was basically written by people with disabilities.
There's a fairly massive shortage of accessible housing around the country. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, one of the things that we're trying to do is to give vouchers for people getting out of nursing homes, so that they can move into their own place. Colorado has a program like that, and we're working on that with HUD. We're also trying to expand the definition of homelessness to include people in institutions.
Interesting.
Because certainly they're not at home.
Mm. That's true.
And so there are so many different components to the Disability Integration Act. I think if you go to disabilityintegrationact.org, you'll read so much on it. And the supporters, I think we have well over 800 groups who support the Disability Integration Act. At the reintroduction, AARP
right
came out in support of the DIA, Disability Integration Act. Centene, which one of the larger insurance companies, they're on board. They announced back in July their support for the Disability Integration Act. Pretty much the majority of disability organizations on the local, state, and national level, you know, are for this, as well as other organizations, such as the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
I'm sure you are, you might even have firsthand knowledge on that sometimes PCA support is limited to people. Like, not only do they not make a living wage, as we talked about, but people's ability to have enough PCA so they can be independent in their own homes is...
That's a major issue.
Yes.
Because what happens is that you have, like, for instance, here in New York, you have the county nurse determining how many hours you get. And most often, it is far less than what you need. And that happens all over the country. Someone is making a determination of the hours that you need and not really paying much attention to what you as the person needing the services are trying to tell them. One of the things that the Disability Integration Act would do is it would get rid of, you know how they're waiting lists?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. To get services?
Right.
It will get rid of the waiting list. In many states, you are forced to rely on informal support. Like, oh, you live with your mom. Let your mom do your attendant work.
Yeah.
DIA would prohibit that. The DIA also says that there can be no discrimination on the basis of when you got your disability, what your disability is. You know, there can be no discrimination on that, all tied up in that civil rights. And it gives, I think there's a 10-year, you know, period where the states and all can prepare and get things, you know, get their infrastructure and everything set up for this. So it's not like we're expecting them to comply like right now or comply yesterday. You know, we give ample time for states to get their infrastructure together.
So one of the problems I find is that there's a timeline set up, and that's all great. I love timelines. But who's there in the end to enforce if it's not complied with?
Well, that's a good question. And I am positive that that DIA has that in mind. I just don't know offhand.
Right,
my health
right.
hasn't been the great, and I don't know offhand what it is, but I know that that was certainly looked into, and there are provisions for that, so that if you're not in compliance, you know, then you will, for lack of better words, you will be put in check. You'll be warned that this is not good. And there, I believe, are some incentives for people to, you know, remain in compliance.
Right.
But there are systems put in place in case they're not compliant. There's no compliance.
But you know where I'm going with
that,
right?
They're really slow to comply.
Right. You know where I'm going with that, because we've seen this happen several times in the disability community where they give you a timeline and say, you have to have your websites accessible by this time, yet we're still fighting that battle. So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's why there was so much outrage against H.R. 620. You know, in that at the time it was written, it was 27 years after the ADA, and we're still having to give you 90 days, you know, to rectify this problem when you've had 28 years to do so.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was something that we were, you know, that we were looking at, you know, the ADA was definitely, I mean, you look at Amtrak. Mm-hmm. Amtrak was supposed to have all of their spaces accessible by the year 2020. That is not going to happen. They sent word a few years ago that that wasn't going to happen. You know, and Greyhound, you still have issues with Greyhound, with lifts that don't work, with attitudes towards people with disabilities, particularly people who use mobility equipment. My last trip on Greyhound, I sat in the accessible seating because I make sure that on my ticket it says that I'm disabled and that I need assistance and all. So I sat in the accessible seating, and the bus driver threatened to put me off of the bus if I didn't move from that seating that I had a right to be in.
Who was he thinking he'd put in that seating?
Probably his lunchbox.
He said that it was for the bus drivers and for their stuff.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And I said, no, that is not true. Don't you see the signs here that says accessible seating? So it was pretty bad. I had to inform him that I was not some inconsequential riffraff that he was dealing with, that I am a nationally known disability rights activist, and that if he thought he was going to put me off of the bus for sitting in seating that I had the right to be in, that he had another thought coming.
Good for you.
So,
and he apologized profusely to me.
Excellent. Good. It's good when those things get
settled. But that's just me. I have a friend who uses a wheelchair who every single time, I just want to cry for him because he just goes through it every single time. So obviously, you know, society really isn't ready to deal with us. They see us as a burden. They see us as a problem. They see somebody in a wheelchair coming, or see somebody like me coming, and then, oh, goodness.
And how do we change
And when that's the attitude, and I'm sorry, that's the attitude of society. You know, and often that is our biggest hurdle, you know, is not our disability. It's the societal attitudes and barriers that are placed before us.
And so how do we change that? Because it's got to change.
It's got to change, but we have to have more than people with disabilities speaking out on this. We have to have constituents of people, of the members of Congress and the Senate who may not necessarily be disabled to demand that they have a disability platform. I see all of these people who are talking about running for office, running for president in 2020. And I guarantee you, none of them will have a disability platform. None of them. I see members of Congress who have signed on to the Disability Integration Act and yet have nothing on their website about this piece of legislation that they support. See, the thing is that to most of society, we're nothing. We're poor. We have no power. The only way you see our power is when you see an ADAPT action. And trust me, when you see an ADAPT action, that is the culmination of months or even years of being told no.
The other thing is, too, I think sometimes, I mean, you talk about everyone with a disability getting involved, and I think that's a huge issue. I think sometimes all hands are not on deck. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, listen, okay. People with disabilities, when you can't even vote because your polling place is either inaccessible or too far from you.
Yeah.
Okay. How's that gonna work? How's that working for our community?
Yeah, we do need to change more on voting.
You know, when you and I look at intersectionality as well. So add to this that you are a person with a disability that happens to be Black, and you live in the South, in one of those jurisdictions that actively suppress the vote. Mm-hmm. How's that working for you? See, I get sick and tired of people telling us, you got to vote, you got to vote, you got to get out there and vote. When for people with disabilities and seniors and folks of color, that's just a little bit impossible. We try. I haven't missed a vote since 18, and I'm almost 54.
Good job.
But trust me, it's not easy.
Right. How do you feel they could help that issue? Because that's a big issue.
Number one, make sure all your polling places are wheelchair accessible and accessible to others with other disabilities. That's the one thing. You know, if you did just that, made your voting machines accessible, or if you use paper ballots, make those accessible. In Colorado, they do mail-in ballots. I couldn't do mail-in ballots because they're inaccessible to me.
Yeah.
And if I hear one more time, well, get someone to help you.
Oh,
no.
That's boo.
You're supposed to be able to vote independently and secretly.
Yes.
I served as an election judge. I was the first disabled person to serve as an election judge for the city and county of Denver. This was back in the 90s. Everywhere I lived, I either served as an election judge or a poll worker. And to see how people with disabilities get treated when we go in to try to vote, it's an atrocity. And you really have to change the minds, you know, of the people. You have to change the minds of your board of elections. You have to change the minds of your precinct captains, you know, the people who are in that apparatus, people with disabilities, if they can, should participate more in that and become election judges and poll workers. When I lived in Washington, D.C., and was the D.C. Metro Disability Vote Organizer, I organized 67 people with disabilities to serve as poll workers in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
That's how I do it. That's a passion of mine, to be able to get people with disabilities to vote and to be able to vote secretly and independently, as is our right and our duty.
I am lucky to have a polling place that is accessible, but I do know there are many that are not.
You put polling places in churches or inaccessible places, you know, or even, for example, if you are having political meetings in places. I remember when President Obama was first elected, and he had a transition team, and they were holding meetings throughout various cities, you know, working on these issues. So I went, and the place where I went was, not only was it inaccessible, it was illegally inaccessible because the place had just been refurbished. Okay, and when you refurbish and renovate, you are supposed to make those places accessible.
Yes.
And they did not.
So that's one of those laws that were passed that never get finished. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I managed to get in. They put a piece of plywood out there and got me in, only to discover that the meeting was going to be on the second floor. Oh. And there was no elevator. And I said, you will hold that meeting on this first floor. Well, I have my cell phone, and I can make one call. And we can have a few of that folks over here, and this meeting will not take place.
Did they
do
it?
So they reluctantly held the meeting on the first floor. And then as I was leaving, I spoke to the owner and the manager of the building and told them, this is not the last you have heard from me. I would like to roll up my sleeves and work with you on getting a ramp in here. And thankfully, 30 days to the day, there was a ramp.
Wow. That's good work.
And it's sad that we have to keep on doing this.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
But that shows you the mentality of people.
Anita, clearly you have a lot of go-get-em. You have a lot of perseverance. You are an awesome advocate. How do you pass that to somebody? How do you teach someone to have that?
I do it all the time, so it's second nature. I especially pick up on new ADAPT folks who may be a little shy. And I mentor them and I teach them and encourage them. Sometimes if I'm able, I go to their state or their city and work with them. And, you know, I tell them, be brave. You have to be brave. You cannot give up. You are on the shoulders of many who went before you, and you cannot fail them. And you cannot fail yourself, your family members, you know, or your community. I tend to be very gentle, and I push forward, and I lift up any kind of activism that people can do. I try to meet people where they are. I know a lot of people who are stuck at home and they can't get out. And I tell them, you do activism the best way you can. If you are stuck in your bed, and I have friends like that who are literally bedborn, if the only way that you can do activism is to sign petitions and put them out and signal boost other people's work, that's what you do. And I'm happy for that. If you are a person, we have a person in one of our DAP chapters who is not able to deal with the noise of accents.
Right.
But that person does a lot from behind the scenes. And I totally lift that up. You know, if all you can do is come and bring food, hand warmers, blankets. If all you can do is come by and say hello and give a couple of hugs, I'm good with that. Because you are doing what you can do. I'm not one of the activism snobs that say the only way to do activism is to get out in the street and get arrested. That is a privilege.
That does happen.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, it happens a lot. Oh, trust me, I see disability activists shaming other disability activists because they can't get out in the trenches. Oh. And my thing is, stop that. You do activism in the way that you can. And that's what I lift up.
That's an excellent thing to do. We're going to have to leave, but Anita, tell people how they can become part of ADAPT.
Go to www.adapt.org. And there's a section on there that gives advice about starting your own chapter. We have an emerging group. And so if you want to know about that, if you're interested in starting an ADAPT chapter, get up with me. AnitaCameron007@gmail.com. AnitaCameron007@gmail.com. Write to me, and I will hook you up with the people that you need to talk to.
You okay if I publish that on the website?
Of course.
Excellent. Well, it's been an honor speaking with you. Thank you so much. I loved hearing the stories, and keep up the good work, and I appreciate what you are doing. Thank you very
much. Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
You are so welcome. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the producer and host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis or KFAI.org. If you'd like to express your opinions or questions or have a suggestion for Disability and Progress, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Yes, indeed, the email has changed. disabilityandprogress@samjasmine, SAMJASMINE.com. Thank you so much for listening. Good night.
KFAI.org.